How do you respond when something doesn't go your way? Maybe you've come home with this pizza order and you open it up and realize you have the wrong pizza. Or you open up your McDonald's drive-thru and realize that there's no fries or the straw is missing. I mean, how do you respond? I mean, those are simple things, right? But how do you respond when you bite into your sub and realize that it's not chicken but steak, right? What do you do? And what do you do when it becomes more complicated than that? I was reading this week in terms of neighbor disputes, a variety of disputes that arise between neighbors in Canada. I mean, one gentleman, one night with an ongoing dispute between neighbors, had come to such a point that he was video surveilling his neighbor. I mean, I can't even imagine this. Some of you may be doing that. We can talk later. So he's video surveilling his neighbor, and he's put his canoe on top of his vehicle to go on a trip the next day. And as he's watching that night, he sees his neighbor go out to where he secured his canoe to his vehicle and sees that he starts to cut away at the ropes they're securing, not all the way through, but enough through that when the wind would catch it, the canoe would blow off the top of his vehicle. But he had video surveillance, so of course he calls the police get involved. You know, what do you do when you have a shared driveway? This is again another story I read this week. And the tension has escalated. Both of your garages are at the back of your homes. If you haven't seen homes like these, they exist. Certain period of time in our history, Canadian history, became a smart idea to create a shared driveway with two garages at the back. One lane, two garages at the back behind each of the homes. And you come home to your driveway in order to get your vehicle out because you've just walked to work to find that your neighbor has put a bin for his renovations in the driveway. Your vehicle is back behind it on your property and you can no longer get out of your shared driveway. What do you do? Well, you order a bin and put it on his front yard. That's what they did. I mean, what I read this week was insanity. Another neighbor, you know, where you struggle and there's a crack house across the street. And so now you're living with your kids across the street from a crack house. And as you do so and people are up all hours and they're all times of day, you have to figure out how you're going to retaliate. What does it work? And so you go out and buy a bigger, better stereo system than your neighbors have to try to outblast them, right? But the police show up at your door, not theirs. What do you do? What do you do when tensions mount? What do you do when things go awry? What do you do when it's part of your family, when it's part of your friendship? I mean, I kept reading, and it's shocking to read, you know, in the bathroom stalls, and not saying you should ever call these numbers, but it used to be, you know, for a good time call. Don't ever call that number, right? And I can guarantee you it's not the number of the person whose number it is didn't write that on the bathroom stall, right? And now people do it on social media. They hack people's social media. They get involved with stuff like that. They create fake accounts. And what do you do when it's about your faith? When the tension that mounts, the difficulty that mounts is about your actual faith. I mean, a number of years ago, we had a young woman here, Anna. She was actually in our wedding party when we were younger as well. And when Anna was 16, God had saved her. She wanted to be baptized. She came from a Buddhist home. And her family told her if she was baptized, she would be disowned and she would be kicked out of their house. So what do you do? She felt like in obedience to Christ, she should be baptized, but she also felt that she was to honor her parents. So what do you do in that moment when God has saved her, when her life has been transformed, she wants to be baptized, and how do you respond? How do you talk to your parents? How do you talk to your neighbors? What do you do? Singh was raised in a high-caste Sikh family in India. And as Sikh was raised in that family at 13, he encountered a Christian family and a Christian friend. And as he was struggling with questions about eternity and life and struggling with what he should do, Sikh's friends said, you need to trust Jesus at 13. Sikh had never heard about Jesus before, knew nothing of him. And as he began to explore who Jesus was, he thought, surely this can't be true. He went off to college, his family, an incredibly wealthy family in India. And as he went off to college and university, he struggled. And as he struggled, he ended up engaging in drugs and alcohol. And at a low point, went to another friend and said, I don't know what to do. And his friend said, you need Jesus to save you. Torn by what he heard, he went to one of his teachers that he greatly respected and said, I'm lost. And that same teacher on that same day said, who you need is Jesus Christ. Saying that I was overwhelmed by the number of people who in my life had pointed and directed me to this person of Jesus Christ, and I gave my life to him. He said, my life was immediately changed. It was changed drastically and incredibly quickly. I went home and told my parents of the transformation. Coming from a high caste Sikh home, they were, of course, incredibly disillusioned and upset by it, but thought they would just walk with me through it. Shortly after, they took the Bible. I hadn't discarded it. So he says, I got another Bible. I ripped the Bible to shreds, all the pages out, so that I could hide the Bible in different places so they couldn't find a Bible and I could continue to read it. He said, as I became more convinced that the gospel was true, as God had saved me, I cut my hair and I stopped wearing my turban. I would no longer go to the Sikh temple to worship with my family. And finally, my dad one day gave me an ultimatum, and he said, either you renounce your faith or you renounce your family. That is your choice. Singh said, I knew I couldn't renounce my faith, and so I left home. My dad gave me 10 days. He said, I went off to Bible college, and I studied at Bible college. I didn't tell my family where I was for fear of my life. And as I was there, I found out that my parents began to persecute a friend of mine who knew where I was and had promised him that they would even kill him if he didn't reveal my location. Singh says, I went home to tell my parents that their quarrel is with me, not with my friends, that this was to stop. And my dad said, I want you to know one time I had 3 sons, but now I have 2. One has died. And Singh said, through this entire time, I prayed for my family, asking God to save them, asking God to grant me witness, asking God to allow me to be someone who would have this effect on their lives that would lead them to Christ. Singh says, I went off to Bible college from university where I studied the word. He's now a pastor, leading Sikh people to faith in Christ. That's what he does. But he would say to this day, his parents and family are at animosity with him. What do you do? I mean, sometimes we can be at odds with people because of our faith. Conflict between parents and children because of ways we want them to live or ways that we are living. Difficulty at work because we have somehow had this standard and feel like what's being done is a little on the unethical side and won't partake in it. And in doing so, are kind of blacklisted, don't receive that promotion. We write something in a paper at school that expresses our faith because we feel it's important given what this paper is. And we know we're docked a full grade for it. But sometimes life isn't just about the persecution of our faith. Sometimes you just end up in a difficult situation. I mean, you can end up with a neighbor who starts to cut the straps on your canoe. You can end up with someone who just places a dumpster there. You can be somewhere where someone, you know, tries to derail your life. And how do you respond to that? What does that look like? Paul, as he runs into Romans 12, talks about because or in view of God's mercy, in light of the work of God in your life, our lives are to be transformed, not conformed, and the transforming of our lives is a continual work and effort of God's Spirit in our life, and our minds are to be renewed. And so in chapter 12 and following, what Paul's doing is he's saying, this is what a renewed mind looks like, and this is how a renewed mind lives. So here are these words, and then we'll take a look at these verses today. Romans 12, beginning at verse 14. Bless those who persecute you. Bless and do not curse. Rejoice with those who rejoice. Mourn with those who mourn. Live in harmony with one another. Do not be proud, but be willing to associate with people of low position. Do not be conceited. Do not repay anyone evil for evil. Be careful to do what is right in the eyes of everyone. If it is possible, and as far as it depends on you, live at peace with everyone. Do not take revenge, my dear friends, but leave room for God's wrath. For it is written, it is mine to avenge, I will repay, says the Lord. On the contrary, if your enemy is hungry, feed him. If he is thirsty, give him something to drink. In doing this, you will heap burning coals on his head. Do not be overcome by evil, but overcome evil with good. That is the word of the Lord. What you've just heard is how a transformed life whose life has been renewed lives. That is how a transformed life whose life has been renewed will live. And every relationship you are in will be defined by your life and how you've been renewed. Every relationship you are in will be defined predominantly by your life and how you've been renewed. So let's take a walk through some of these. First, engage hostility with blessing, not curse. Engage hostility with blessing, not curse. Verse 14, bless those who persecute you. Bless and do not curse. This reminds us of Jesus, Matthew 5. You've heard that it was said, love your neighbor and hate your enemy. But I tell you, love your enemies and pray for those who persecute you, that it may be, that you may be children of your Father in heaven. Paul here says you're to bless those who persecute you and not curse them. In those days, the blessing and cursing is very different than our days. Cursing is not swearing at them. You see, we see curse and we think, yeah, I shouldn't swear at people. Got it. The curse was where you would utter God's judgment on someone. The curse is where you would say, I want God to deal with you severely. And what he says is, when you're thinking of those that are persecuting you, I want you to bless them. The blessing is not just you doing something tangibly for them. The blessing is you actually coming before God and crying out to God on their behalf. The blessing is saying, oh God, would they know your strength? Oh God, would they know your grace? Oh God, would they know your mercy? The blessing is saying, God, would you bring them, those that are persecuting me, would you bring them good? It's a tall order, isn't it? You see, we want something bad to happen to people. We're actually hoping that when someone has taken something out on us, our knee-jerk reaction is, get them, God, right? God, would you fix them? God, would you, and not fix in a good way. Not, God, would you correct them? God, would you get them? Like, God, come on, do something spectacular and, like, crush them, right? Now, we may never say that out loud because it doesn't sound very good, but in our heart of hearts, that's often how we react. Someone's been bitter to us or resentful, right? Someone's harmed us in some way. Someone's said something about us that's untrue. Someone's gossiped about us. Someone's lied to us, a neighbor dispute, whatever it would be, persecution for your faith. Our first reaction is, go get them, God. And Paul here says, if you understand the mercy of God and your life is being transformed, your mind is being renewed, your first reaction will actually be, God, would you bless them? God, would you strengthen them? God, would you give them hope? Your first reaction shouldn't be to curse them, but rather the very opposite, but to say, God, be with them. God, show up. So that begs the question, how renewed is our mind? How renewed is our mind? Because that's not often the way that most of us want to react. We want to get them. Well, Paul continues. He says, not only are you to ask God's best on him, but you're to rejoice with those who rejoice, and you're to mourn with those who mourn. You're to live empathetically and not indifferently or cold-heartedly. You're to live empathetically and not indifferently or hard-heartedly, cold and hard-heartedly. Rejoice with those who rejoice. You see, when someone has wronged us, we rejoice when they mourn, and we mourn when they rejoice. Did you hear that? When someone has wronged us, we rejoice when they mourn, and we mourn when they rejoice. When someone has wronged us and they get a promotion at work, we're like, they didn't deserve that. When someone has wronged us and all of a sudden we hear that something good has happened in life, we're like, they shouldn't have gotten that. We actually mourn when they rejoice. And then when they're mourning, we rejoice. They had that coming to them. They deserved that. Oh, we might never say it out loud, right? But we hear about the car accident they got in, and we think, you know, they had that coming. We hear about the disease that they're stricken with, and we feel like, you know, they deserved it. And it speaks to the wickedness of our heart. Oh, they're HIV positive? Well, they deserved it for all their promiscuity. And we'll judge people. And Paul says here, we're to rejoice when people rejoice, and we're to mourn when people mourn. If you find yourself ever rejoicing when people are mourning, and you find yourself ever mourning when people are rejoicing, God says something's wrong way deep inside here. Something's gone awry. And the transforming of your life by his mercy has not come to completion because he longs for your mind to be renewed so that you rejoice when people rejoice and you mourn when people are mourn, including those that persecute you.
including those that persecute you.
I'm not saying this is easy. I'm just saying it's necessary. Because it's the word of the Lord. And so, God, what do you need to do in my life to change my life so that I rejoice when people rejoice and I mourn with those who mourn? And then we follow the example of Christ to live in harmony with each other. Do not be proud, but be willing to associate with people of low position. Do not be conceited. Be humble, not haughty. Don't ever look upon what someone else is doing as if it's lower than you. Don't ever look upon what someone else is doing as if it's beneath you. Whether it's a job, something they're employed with, or it's something they've done. The only difference between us and anyone else is the grace of God. And I haven't earned his grace. I haven't procured his favor. I haven't in any way said, I deserve this. God's just granted me grace. He's granted grace. And because he's granted this grace, my life starts to look different. And the way I treat people, and the way I interact with others, and the way... And so I can't ever look at anyone who's beneath me because no one is beneath me. That's why just earlier in the passage, Paul says that we're to honor one another above ourselves. In other passages, we were to think of others before ourselves. That we're to be constantly thinking about others. We're to be other-centered. We're to be thinking about how to walk alongside of them, how to love them. If we're in conflict with someone, we think about how to bring harmony to that situation. And we're never conceited, feeling like, well, you know, man, if you knew who I was... Do you know how many degrees I have? Do you know how well I did at those degrees? Do you know how many trades I have? Do you know how skilled I am at this? Do you know how much I know about this? Do you know how much I know about this? Do you know the kind of athletic ability I have? Do you understand who you're talking to here? Paul says, live in harmony with each other. Don't ever be proud. Be willing to associate with people of low position. Don't ever be conceited. Reminds us of Jesus when he's at the home of the Pharisee and everyone's gathered and Jesus kind of just breaks in and says, hey, you know, you think you're really good because you've invited your friends and family over for dinner, but that's not what the kingdom's about. You see, what they would do in those days is they would invite people who they knew would invite them back. And if they could, you would invite people one class up from you. Because if you invited people one class up from you and they reciprocated by coming to your home, and then they invited you into their home, you're now in a social setting that's one class up from you, invited in, which grants you the opportunity to move up that class. Does that make sense? So it's really common in that day. You invited people of your class, and you tried to invite people of the next class up. And then Jesus in the gospel says, if you think inviting people like that to your party is what you should do, you've got it all wrong. He said, I want you to invite people in that will never invite you back, and that no one else will have over. That's what the kingdom looks like. And we hear that and think, man, that sounds great. That's what I should be doing. But it's not how most of us live. Now, Jesus isn't saying you can't ever have people over. I mean, you know, this week's Abby's birthday, she turns 15, and at some point we'll have family over to celebrate. He's not saying, say to your daughter, sorry, you know, we're going to invite in a whole bunch of people that you don't like and don't know into the house, and the people that you do like and do know can't come anymore. No. He's not saying you can't ever have people over that you know. But what Jesus is saying is if you look at the kind of the breadth of your life and you're never inviting people in that can never reciprocate, you're never inviting people in and hanging out with people that will never offer you advantage for you associating with them. There's no advantage for them, for you, sorry, at all. You're just loving on them. You're just caring for them. You're just, in Jesus' name, offering peace. He said, if that's not you, then the gospel really hasn't taken this effect in your life. That's what Paul's talking about here. Live in harmony with each other. This isn't about you getting your way. This isn't about you doing what you want. This isn't about you knowing the best. Don't be proud. If the degrees, the research, the skill... Be willing to associate with people of low position. Do not become conceited. And then verse 17. So don't repay anyone evil for evil, but be careful to do what is right in everyone's eyes. If it is possible, and as far as it depends on you, live at peace with everyone. Paul, if you could phrase it this way, says this. You should be after peace and not payback. Whew. That's like blessing and not cursing, right? I mean, first, we want God to get them, right? God, would you look after them? And in an evil, corrupt way, God, not that you're evil and corrupt, but I am, and so would you just kind of crush them? And Paul says, no. Ask for God's blessing on them, not God's curse. In asking for God's blessing, you're asking for God's best, for God's hope, for God's grace, for God's peace. And then he comes to this portion of the verse after saying, don't ever think that anyone is lower than you. Make sure you're rejoicing with those who rejoice and mourning with those who mourn. He says, don't ever repay anyone evil for evil. This isn't tit for tat. This isn't you did this, I'll do that. Be careful to do what is right in the eyes of everyone. When everyone sees what you're doing, like, wow, that was, whew, that took the high ground, man. They had every right to go at them, and instead they took the higher ground. If it is possible, as far as it depends on you, did you catch that? Live at peace with everyone. There are times when there are people that you can't live at peace with. But don't let it ever be because of you. There will be times when you just can't live peaceably with people, but Paul says here, don't ever let that be because of you. If it is possible, as far as you can do it, and as long as it depends on you, to the greatest extent that you can do it, would you live at peace with everyone? Don't ever repay evil for evil. I was talking to someone in the last couple of weeks who's gone through some horrors in their life, and as we were talking through them and trying to figure out some best next steps, they felt the Lord had really offered some healing, and I was suggesting some counseling and some stuff that might be helpful, and they felt that the Lord had really offered some healing. And then they said to me, don't you know anyone where they've been through kind of these atrocities and God's really healed them? And I didn't tell you I was going to do this morning, but I know you told me. I thought of Amy, my wife. Right? She grew up in a home of an alcoholic. I've shared her story numbers of times publicly. Right? Dad was horribly abusive to her. And a few years ago when he was dying in his alcoholism, like dying in it, sometimes yelling at us, screaming at us, accusing us of all kinds of things, stealing from him, you know, Amy would graciously go over and wash all of his clothes that he puked on and clean up all the mess that would be there and sometimes bring food to make sure he had something to eat. And when we were there, dump the alcohol out so it was gone and you have to figure out what to do the next day. You know, I remember going over one time, he'd shut the heat off by accident. The house was down to like 45 degrees, right? It's a boiler system, and go over and make sure there's enough blankets and turn the heat up. And while I'm there trying to fix the whole thing, he'd accuse me of sabotaging the whole thing. Thought I had done the whole thing. I was there to fix it, you know. But as I thought through that, I mean, I can tell you, humanly speaking, Amy had every right to repay evil for evil because there was a lot of evil. But she chose not to. God graciously saved her when she was 17 out of the ministry of Kelly Ocherek, who attends our church and this church ministry before I was here. I didn't fall in love with her till she was 20. I just want you to know that. It wasn't creepy. And I wasn't the pastor when God saved her here. I wasn't even here. But we did everything to live at peace with her dad, and he didn't want it. To the very end, he was defiant. But I can tell you, I saw this in my wife's life. If it is possible, and as far as it depended on her, she strove to live at peace with him. And that's what we should do. But sometimes it's not possible. And sometimes you've gone to X extent to love on someone and care for someone, and they're still hostile, and they're still difficult. I remember taking Ethan over to his place one time to shovel the snow. I brought my salt, my shovel. I'm on the sidewalk shoveling the snow, and I'm doing it so he doesn't get fined by the city anymore. He had these corner lots on Lake Avenue, big homes, two big homes, worth a fair bit of money, but they were debt-ridden. I mean, he'd mortgage one against the other to live for years, right? Because he made money at one time in his life, lost it all to alcoholism, and man, massive amounts of debt, and we're shoveling his walk with our stuff, and my little boy's there, and he comes out, and he's screaming at us, he's throwing at us, and he's half naked, he has nothing on from the bottoms down, and he just falls into the snow and needs help getting up, and you were trying to do good, and trying to offer love, and sometimes it's hard. And in that moment, you want to curse the very person that you're now to bless. In that moment, you want payback, not peace. God says, if your mind has been renewed and your life is being transformed and you're thankful for the mercy of God, make sure that you're someone who blesses those who persecute you and don't curse them. That you never repay evil for evil, but as if it is possible and as long as it depends on you, you live at peace with everyone. You know, according to recent research verified by three or four sources, there's about 255 Christians that are killed every year. Every month, not every year. 255 Christians that are killed every month. 166 churches that are attacked every month somewhere in the world. There are 160 Christians detained every month in the world without trial or evidence. And then Paul says this: do not take revenge, my dear friends, but leave room for God's wrath. For it is written, it is mine to avenge, and I will repay, says the Lord. You see, you don't in any way ask God to get them. You actually ask God to bless them. But you trust that God will do what is just because he will. You just say, God, I leave this in your hands. God, I'm praying your blessing on them. God, I'm praying your best on them. God, as far as it is in terms of me, I'm never going to repay evil for evil. But I know that you are a God who is just. I know that you are a God who is holy. I know that sin can never enter into your presence. And I know that one day every injustice will be looked after by you in judgment. And God, I know you're a God of wrath. It's true. God hates sin. And he is a God of wrath. That's why there's hell, right? Hell is not Satan's domain. Hell is God's domain. God has created hell. It's his. He throws Satan into hell. It belongs to him. And he is a God of wrath. He is a God of love, right? God is not wrath. God is love. By his very nature and essence and character, God is love. He is not wrath. It's not his nature and character and disposition, but he is wrathful. What does that mean? It means that though God's very nature and disposition is love, his nature and disposition is also holiness. And because that is true of God, God cannot look upon sin. And so his character necessitates punishment for anything that is outside of his will. But gloriously, what he's done in Christ is Christ took that punishment on the cross on our behalf for any who believe. That is the gospel. And so his wrath is exposed right there in that moment on the cross to his son instead of us, and we get his grace. But God says for anyone who's not under that grace, for anyone who chooses to rebel against him, there will be wrath. And this is what Paul's saying here, that I want you to know that one day God will look after all of this. And it's going to be looked after in one of two ways. He's either going to save them. There's lots of people we think are beyond God's saving. No one is beyond the grace of God. Is that not good news? No one is beyond his love. No one is beyond his hope. No one is beyond his reach. That's why we bless those who persecute us. God, would you save them? I'm going to tell one more story, Amy. I remember when Amy's dad had died, and it was a mess. There was hoarding and, you know, there was a mess. And people came and helped us, you know, at the end, after everything was paid off, there was kind of a little bit of inheritance. And someone had kind of said to Amy at one point, man, it must be nice that there's a little bit of inheritance at the end. And Amy's like, I didn't really want an inheritance. I'll never forget this. She said, I just wanted my dad. And I wish he had been saved. You see, that should be our disposition, right? Oh, God, would you save these people? God, would you show them the light? God, the only reason my eyes have been enlightened and open is because of your grace. God, would you powerfully work in their lives? God, would you show up? And if in their rebelliousness they choose to reject him, there is wrath. And God says, I want you to know that you can leave this with him. You don't need to act evil for evil. You don't need to curse those who are persecuting. God's got it all. You can trust him. You can trust him. Can I promise you that any God who's going to show up into time and space for you, any God who's going to cloak his deity with humanity and live as a newborn for you, Any God who's going to live sinlessly and yet at the end of his life die for you. Any God who's going to go through a forsakenness on the cross as he's dying on the cross and he calls out, my God, why have you forsaken me? As he experiences this isolation for you. That any God who will do that for you is never, ever, ever going to harm you. He's only going to ever give you good. That's what God will do. So Paul says, don't take revenge. Leave room for God's wrath. It is mine to avenge, and I will repay. So then in my research this week, I was stunned. I knew there had been persecution in Nigeria. I did not understand to the extent. Do you know that between January and June of 2018, 6,000 Christians have been killed in Nigeria, and 1 million people are running right now, fleeing, because of the intense persecution that's been going on in Nigeria. And so then I read the story of Rebecca, right, who was taken by an extreme Muslim group and kidnapped. They took her and her 3-year-old son. They tortured her. They beat her, asking her to renounce her faith, and they wouldn't. She wouldn't. She had to watch her little 3-year-old boy die in front of her. They slaughtered and killed him in front of her because she would not renounce her faith. And then as they continued to humiliate her and beat her and torture her and rape her, she became pregnant. Not knowing who the father would be, she was raped by so many men. And when you recount and hear her story, she talks through the entire story about her prayer of God saving her captors, of her responding with peace and not payback, of when she was released, not wanting the people to go back and kill all these men, but rather show them grace, believing that then God might too. That's how she responded. Has your life been that transformed? Has your mind been that renewed? I mean, what does Paul say? Don't take revenge. It's not yours to take, my dear friends. Leave room for God's wrath. It is written, it's his to avenge. I will repay. God will look after every form of evil. Is that not good news? God is always, only, ever against evil, and he hates it. And one day he's creating a place for us where we will exist forever. I actually believe we'll live on the new earth. I don't believe there's a new heaven and new earth for the purpose of us living in heaven and looking down at the earth. I think we'll live on the new earth. It doesn't make sense to me that we'll live in the heavens looking down on the earth. I think the angelic realm will still be part of the new heavens. But God will dwell with us, it tells us, on the new earth. And so I believe we'll be there on the new earth. And as we're there on the new earth, and we're enjoying this place, it'll be a place where I'll never be tempted to sin again. Temptation will never come my way. It'll be a place free from evil. No one will ever harm anyone. No one will ever hurt anyone. No one will ever gossip against anyone. No one will ever in any way bring any form of evil toward anyone. We will live in harmony. There will be no pride. We will enjoy each other's company in pure fellowship that will be that won't have any form of incumbents. And we will do that forever. And the centerpiece of this place will be the Lord himself. We will worship him and enjoy him forever and ever, where there will be no disease, there'll be no heartache, there'll be no hurt, there'll be no death, there'll be no pain, there'll be no temptation, there'll be no sin, there'll be no evil. I mean, God hates it so much that in the new order, in the new creation, it won't be allowed in. Ever. And God says, I want you to know when all things come to fruition, when my son himself returns, I want you to know I will avenge. I will judge. And while you wait, would you bless those who persecute? Don't curse them. Would you act with patience and not payback? Would you rejoice with those who rejoice and mourn with those who mourn? Verse 20. On the contrary, if your enemy is hungry, feed him. If he's thirsty, give him something to drink. Whew. He says, if you've got someone that's that upset with you, someone that's at odds with you in that extent, feed them. Offer them something to drink. Come alongside of them. Love them in Jesus' name. Just come alongside of them and bless them. You see, when you do tit for tat, when they're angry and you're angry, when they do evil and you do evil, you just infuse the whole situation, and he's saying, diffuse it. Just diffuse the whole situation. As much as you are able to and as far as it depends on you. That's what he says, right in the verse. But when you're mourning with them because they're mourning, even though they've been awful to you, you take them a meal and say, hey, I'm really sorry that your mother died. Because you actually mourn with those who mourn. I heard you had cancer. Is there anything we can do? Can we help you with trips to the hospital? Can we assist you with... I heard your parents are divorcing. Want to go out for a coffee and talk about it? Like, is there... And when they don't know how to respond, when they're not sure what to do, maybe not even knowing whether or not to accept what you're offering them or not, and they question who you are, you let them know that you're someone whose life has been transformed by the mercy of God and whose mind is being renewed. Because you're someone who will feed your enemy when they're hungry, give them something to drink when they're thirsty, and in doing this, you heap burning coals on their head. Now, this is a controversial little part of the passage because some people think when you go back, it's a quote from Proverbs 25, that in that context in Proverbs 25, in the king's context, the whole idea there is you do good for someone who's done evil to you so that God will judge him, right? In doing this, you heap burning coals in their head. May they feel the judgment of God coming. I believe in this context of you blessing and not cursing, being patient or peaceful, sorry, and not pay back, in not repaying evil for evil, but allowing God, trusting that God will look after it. I believe in this context that the idea of burning, heaping coals on their head is that they may see the glory of the hope and life of Jesus Christ shining through you, may turn from their sin and trust him. I believe the burning of heaping coals on their head is that they will come to a place of shame, of condemnation even for their own sin, recognizing that, what do I do now? I've done my best to bring evil. I've done my best to come against them. And they're responding in love, and they're responding in grace, and they're responding in peace, and they're responding in hope. What do I do now? And that they'll realize the only thing they can do is turn to the very God who's transformed your very life. That's all they got. Because the amount of evil they brought hasn't in any way persuaded you. It hasn't changed you. You're not responding the way they expect you to respond. You're not cursing them when they curse you. You're not replying with evil when they're evil to you. You're not harming them when they harm you. You're bringing food, you're bringing drink, you're offering rides, you're coming alongside, you're saying, here. And all of a sudden, they're just heaped with burning coals, with shame of, what do I do now? Some of you are sitting here in high school and university, and you live in an environment where people do payback and form cliques and are in clubs all the time. And could you imagine what your school would look like if there was a whole group of you, of Christians, that always responded with grace and always responded with love and always responded with hope and prayed for the people that were against you and loved the people that couldn't stand you? I mean, what would that look like in your life? What would that be like? I remember Peter Gooch was here. He was a teacher of mine when I was in high school, and he would write proverbs at the top of the board. His wife suffered a serious stroke a year and a half ago, 2 years ago, and they got some medical attention before Christmas down here at the General, and they came here 3 Sundays. She was in a wheelchair. If you talked to her, she was unable to communicate. She can understand everything, but unable to communicate to you. And, you know, Peter often wondered if his witness meant anything. Right? Like, did this witness, did me trying to be just this godly influence in the school, did it mean anything? But I'll tell you, I noticed as a Christian kid. And years later, as I look back, there's 3 or 4 of my friends from high school that God has saved. Recently, someone called me just before Christmas and said, Dwayne, God's been at work in my life. I remember being in this girl's home. I remember her mom debating me. I mean, whew, like it was antagonistic. It was intense. It was at times disturbing. Her mom would just go at me and at me. You're a fool to believe there's a God. You're a fool. And I'm, you know, you're 16 and 17, and you're doing your best to defend the existence of God and what that looks like. And you're like, oh, you know, I don't really know all the answers to this. And then this, you know, this, she's my age. This friend of mine calls me and says, Dwayne, I was wondering, you know, God has saved me. I'd like to be baptized, but I thought, would you do it? I said, wow. She said, I want all my family and friends. I said, will your mom even come? Oh, she said, I should have told you, God saved my mom. I'm like, pardon? God saved your mom. She's like, yeah, she goes to Lake Mount, like in Grimsby, like with Matt Tapley. She's like, yeah. I'm like, that's an amazing church. She's like, I know. I've been there a few times with her, and like God's grabbed a hold of her heart. I'm like, I can't wait to see your mom at this baptism. Oh my goodness, I can't wait to see her. And they talked about the witness of some people in high school, including this teacher, Peter Gooch, who just loved on students. I remember students mocking him for putting the verses up and making fun of him for his Christian faith, and he would always respond with grace. He would always respond with love. He'd always respond with patience. That's just who he was. God had just worked in his life that way, because he transforms hearts. He really does. And so do not be overcome by evil. Don't let evil infiltrate you. That's the idea. But overcome evil with good. You see, when you hate the person who's wronged you, evil has won. When you hate the person who's wronged you, evil has won. Don't be overcome by evil. Don't allow evil to infiltrate your heart. Oh, it's hard. Sometimes it's with family. Sometimes it's with good friends. Sometimes it's with colleagues. Sometimes it's people in complete opposition to the gospel. Don't be overcome by evil. I mean, the idea there is don't collapse under its pressure, but also don't allow it to infiltrate you. But rather overcome evil with good. I got to close here in a few minutes, but is that not the way of the cross? Is the cross not God overcoming evil with good? I mean, so much so that when Jesus is on the cross, and the centurion who's there, maybe in charge of his death, but at least one of the people in charge of his death, who's watching Jesus die, who knows how people die on crosses, who knows that they try to urinate on their executioners, who knows they try to spit on their executioners, who knows that at times they even try to get their own blood on their executioners, who know that they'll curse at their executioners, watches Jesus only respond with grace. Father, forgive them. They don't know what they're doing. John, can you take care of my mom? There, he's dying. In conversation with the criminal on the cross who says, I want you to know today you'll be with me in paradise. And the centurion hears all of this. He's overcome. He's overwhelmed. He says, surely this was the Son of God. Because Jesus overcame evil with good. Is that not great news? Jesus overcame evil with good, and that's what he'll do to the end. That's why he calls us to be good. Because we're now his representatives. People see us and they see him. We represent him. So overcome evil with good. I spoke at an event yesterday morning, and man, a lineup of people talking to me. At the end, this guy waited for quite some time, and he started to talk to me. He's 33, his name's Kevin. And Kevin and his wife were saved in their early 20s, about 12 years ago. God radically gripped their lives. They bought a big, beautiful home. He owns his own business, started it when he was young, makes a fair bit of money, bought a big house in the middle of nowhere, and you know, all the stuff that big house comes with. Parents are very wealthy, Christian parents. And then he sold it all. When he bought a house in one of the poorest areas of St. Catharines. And his family and her family thought they had lost their minds. And they have four kids that are theirs. And every day for years, they'd allow the 15 to 20 neighborhood kids just come in their backyard, because they bought a bit of a bigger property in this poor neighborhood, and come into their home and hang out, and they'd feed the kids, and they'd pray with them, and then they started to teach them to pray, and then they started to show them how to use their Bibles. And then they end up adopting one of the kids that's really struggling, and then they start to foster care. So now there's eight kids in their home because they foster care for a family. And the foster care system couldn't understand this Christian family at first. So they've been doing foster care now for a couple of years, and there's 8 kids in this home every day that this family cares for. And then back in the fall, this family that had the 3 kids have been taken because of the atrocities in the home, this family was becoming healthier. And as parents, Kevin and his wife had gotten to know the parents of these kids and were being a powerful witness to them, because you overcome evil with good. And in becoming that powerful witness to them and walking with them, they're with the social worker and children's aid workers just before, well, sometime in the fall. I don't know the exact timeline. And as they're in the fall talking about a transition plan and what it looks like, the workers are concerned that the kids can't go back to the home environment full time because they won't be able to do their schoolwork. And Kevin and his wife say, why don't they stay with us Monday to Friday? We drop them off on Friday and we take them back Sunday night. And the children's aid worker and the social worker are like, what? You would do this? They're like, yeah, we would do that. And then they say, there's just one condition, Kevin says, that they come to church with us on Sundays. We won't do this without that. And they said, Kevin says, you could see in the room, the children's aid worker and the social worker were like, can they do that? Like, that can't be a condition. Like, and they're having this conversation. And this dad who's struggled with all kinds of stuff in the room says, I'd go to church with them. And I don't know if it's his wife or partner, I'm not sure. She says, I'll go too. And Kevin says every week they're there with the kids at church. So now all of them sit together in church every week. And some weeks they take their kids out. But every Sunday night, this couple drops their kids off for Kevin and his wife. And they're there until Friday night. And every Sunday they sit in church. And Kevin said, God's still at work in their life. He said, we're going back to meet with the system, some of the people, to figure out some stuff. He said, they don't know what to do with this. You see, when you come overcome evil with good, no one understands it. No one knows what to do with it. Oh, they can oppose our Christian values and morals and tell us that we're wrong. But when tangibly you offer someone food who's been harming you, drink who's been hurting you, pray God's blessing on those that are persecuting you, you come and bring peace to a hostile situation when you should be bringing payback. No one knows what to do with that, and good will always overcome evil. If not now, God says, it will one day. And he says, you can trust me in that. You can trust me in that. You can trust me in that. And this, then, is how we should live. Amen? I'm not saying that's easy. I'm not saying I always live this way. I actually was with him yesterday saying, man, you know, before we had the twins, Amy and I had talked about foster care. We'd actually talked about adopting someone with special needs. We talked about a bunch of stuff, and then the twins were born, and that was like, woo, chaos, right? And then life becomes busy with stuff, and we didn't talk about this last night. Now I'm just throwing things out. And I'm not going to promise anything. I'm just, you know, I just got this look like we were even home together last night after women's retreat, what? And I was sitting there thinking to myself as he was talking to me and I was driving home yesterday, you know, Lord, maybe it's time Amy and I had that conversation again. Right? What would that look like? And ironically, when we got home last night, and I hadn't talked to her since Christmas, one of the girls that we took in for 6.5 years texted me and just said, how are you doing? And I just thought to myself as I was praying last night, looking at my message, I thought, wow, Lord, you have a sovereign way about you, don't you? You just do. Don't overcome, be overcome by evil, but overcome evil with good. Overcome evil with good when someone falsely accuses you, when you end up in a neighbor dispute, when there's tension in your family. Overcome evil with good when there's persecution for your faith. Overcome evil with good. Because when you bless those who oppose you, offer peace to those who are hostile toward you, care for those who hate you, and leave justice to God, you overcome evil with good. I'm going to ask Emily and the team to come up and lead us in song. We're going to take a minute and sing a song. And at the end of that song, we're going to just take a moment and pray. Because I, for one, need prayer that the mercy of God that I'm so thankful for, that's transformed my life, will keep renewing my mind so I can live this out.